a region in which there were attempts to establish constitutional governments, and in fact, constitutional governments were established long before they were established in Spain, in Portugal, in most countries of Eastern Europe.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. In his new book, Sowing Crisis, historian Rashid Khalidi says you can find the origins of current conflicts in the Middle East in the icy tentacles of a Cold War. He says that as the U.S. and Soviet Union fought for ideological and political dominance in this oil-rich part of the world, they exploited regional conflicts that still play out today. And the current concern about terrorism, which informs American military strategy in the region, harkens back to the fierce anti-communism of the Cold War. Sowing Crisis is a book that Publishers Weekly has called essential for anyone concerned about stability in the Middle East. Khalidi discussed his new book at the Politics and Prose bookstore on March 5, 2009.
I came to this book in a peculiar way. I was teaching in Beirut at the American University, as Barbara mentioned, and I was asked to do some research on Soviet Middle East policy. And I responded, I can't do any research on Soviet Middle East policy. I don't know Russian. And they said, well, have a look at the literature. Just see if, you know, you feel you could make a contribution. And I had a look at the literature, and I realized that most of the people who wrote on Soviet Middle East policy knew nothing about the politics, history, culture, or anything else of the countries of the Middle East. They knew no Middle Eastern languages, by and large. They worked from the United States or from the Soviet Union. And so I said, well, they're no more ignorant than I am. They don't know Middle Eastern languages, and I never claimed I knew Russian. But because of the generosity of our government in translating a huge volume of materials from the Russian, Current Digest of the Soviet Press, Summary of World Broadcasts, which the British translated, an English speaker like myself had access to pretty much everything that was ever published in Russia. All the public stuff was there. And I was sitting in Beirut, and I had access to a lot of the Middle Eastern materials. So I started working on this topic. And as I started working on it, I realized that most of the things that are written were not just written by people who didn't know very much about the Middle East, but most of the stuff that was written from a perspective which privileged the way either Moscow or more often Washington saw things. And as I suggest in this book, I think that's obviously very important, and I treat that with a great deal of attention. But I try in this book to look at how the Cold War impacted the Middle East from a Middle Eastern perspective. What did the Cold War do to the Middle East? What kind of patterns did the Cold War create that we may still be living with? And I think that is the main lesson I took away from my work on this book, that a lot of stuff that happened in the Middle East as a result of the Cold War, most of it very negative, some of it not entirely negative, are things that were completely ignored in the way in which the Cold War was studied and treated in the Middle East. By and large, people looked at it in terms of advantage. This worked out to the advantage of the United States, or this didn't, or this worked out to the advantage of the Soviets, or this didn't. Most of these things, incidentally, whether they worked out to the advantage of the United States or the Soviet Union, did not work out to the advantage of most Middle Easterners. And that is one of the major points that I try and make in this book. The competition between the superpowers, whatever it may or may not have done for them, did not have good consequences in many respects for Middle Easterners. There's a chapter in this book where I talk about how conflicts in the Middle East were affected by the Cold War. They weren't started by the Cold War, but how they were affected. And by and large, they were affected in a very negative fashion. They were exacerbated. They were made worse. They were envenomed. They were made much, much more violent in some cases. And I deal in particular with the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Lebanon War of 1975 to 1990, and the Iran-Iraq War as my case studies. And what I try and show in the chapter that I devote to this is that the superpowers, for reasons that, you know, may have seemed perfectly good in Washington or in Moscow, in fact were using these conflicts as means to get at one another. This, in the case of the Arab-Israeli conflict, really started in the 1960s. Before that, the United States and the Soviet Union were on the same side, by and large. In 1948, both of them supported Israel. In 1956, both of them supported Egypt. They were in conflict with one another, but the conflict had not yet become polarized along Cold War lines in the 40s or the 50s. That is what, in fact, happened in the 1960s, and the result was an enormous increase in the level of violence because both sides were getting first-line weapons from their superpower patrons. The war of attrition The war that was fought after the 67 war from 1968 to 1970 was infinitely more destructive than the 67 war had been in terms of the sheer destructive power of the weaponry used. The 1973 war involved one of the largest tank battles in history, the largest tank battle since Kursk in 1943, involved huge casualties, is the largest number of casualties in any of Israel's wars, and very large, very, very extensive damage. My point here is that these conflicts in the region were in fact made much worse by the way in which they came to track with the Cold War. As in the case of the Arab countries, they came to be aligned with the Soviet Union. In the case of Israel, it came to be aligned with the United States. And I argue the same thing in looking at both the Lebanon conflict and the Iran-Iraq war. The Iran-Iraq war is probably one of the least honorable case studies in the way in which the Cold War affected Middle Eastern conflicts. Both superpowers supported both combatants at different times during this war. The United States not only supported Iraq in a variety of ways and encouraged its allies to support Iraq in a variety of ways, the United States also saw to it that anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles were shipped to Iran during the Reagan administration in an extension of what was then known as Iran-Contra. The Soviet Union not only supplied most of the weapons that the Iraqis used, they also supplied a large part of the weapons that the Iranians used. And they switched sides quite frequently. And I go back and talk about how this affected this American-Soviet involvement, not just in the 8-year Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, but in earlier phases of conflict between Iran and Iraq, involved not just this kind of cynical support for one or another power, but involved a variety of people in the Middle East getting, as it were, trampled underfoot. And I point out how the Kurds, for example, suffered from the way in which the Soviet Union used them and then dropped them and used them and then dropped them, and from the way in which the United States at different times used them and then dropped them. I quote a horrified aide to Secretary of State Kissinger exclaiming that the United States had abandoned the Kurds after the 1975 Algiers Agreement, when the Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein came to an accord over their border dispute, and suddenly Iranian, American, and Israeli support for the Kurds stopped. And Kissinger replied to this horrified aide, covert action should not be confused with missionary work. And this is an example. I cite other examples of similar cynicism on the part of the Soviet Union. This is an example of how small peoples, how small countries got caught up in the Cold War. I talk in another chapter about how the Cold War had an impact on democracy in this region. Now, let me start by saying something about a widely held myth about the Middle East, and it's something I talked about in an earlier book of mine, Resurrecting Empire. And this is that there never was democracy in the Middle East. This is that the Middle East is a region that has always been plagued by autocracy or authoritarian government. And there's a kernel of truth to this, in that certainly since the 60s or the 70s, the Middle East has been a black hole where democracy is concerned. And inasmuch as the Middle East is where strong centralized autocratic government first developed, before any other part of the world had agriculture, cities, states, empires, centralized governments, for several thousand years, the Middle East had all of these things. So the first powerful centralized governments developed in the Mesopotamian river valleys and in Egypt, thousands of years before they developed anywhere else except possibly China. So there is a tradition of strong autocratic states in the Middle East. And it is true that for the last few decades, the Middle East has been plagued by what we can kindly call a democratic deficit. But this is also a region in which there was an enormous effort to try and bring about a transition to democracy. This is a region in which there were attempts to establish constitutional governments, and in fact, constitutional governments were established long before they were established in Spain, in Portugal, in most countries of Eastern Europe. The Ottoman Constitution of 1876, the Iranian Constitution of 1906 are examples of a desire to see limits on the power of the executive, a desire to see some form of representative government, of constitutional government. So it is also a region which has a tradition of at least certain forces in those societies struggling to achieve some form of democratic government. And in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, from the Sudan to into the 50s, from the Sudan to Egypt to Lebanon to Syria to Jordan to Iraq to Iran, you had democratic governments. What was the impact of the Cold War from the 1950s onwards on these democratic governments? Well, it was not positive. And what I try and show is not only in Iran, where the United States and Britain overthrew the last parliamentary constitutional regime that Iran has ever known, but also in countries, especially small, weak countries like Lebanon and Jordan, the impact of the Cold War was almost entirely negative insofar as the possible development of democracy in these countries is concerned. So the second argument that I make in this book, the second major argument that I make in this book, is that although democracy does not flourish in the Middle East today, there were efforts to establish democratic governance, and the Cold War certainly did not contribute to them, which is not solely to blame our government. It's also to blame the Soviets and the old colonial powers, which played very much the same role in earlier days in undermining democratic experiments, whether in Iran or in other countries of the region, or Turkey and other countries of the region. I think the last point I want to leave you with has to do with both the lasting impact of the Cold War and something that I call the American-Iranian mini Cold War, which in a way is a leftover or a lasting impact of the Cold War. The Cold War, I discovered when I worked on this book, I didn't really realize it before this, caused the development of patterns of behavior on the part of the United States and on the part of the Soviet Union, which I think policymakers in Washington and in Moscow have not really fully gotten rid of. What am I talking about? I'm talking about a focus on rivals in the region rather than on the domestic politics of the countries concerned. When we look at a country like Lebanon, all we're thinking about is Iran. And who might be a proxy for Iran? Who might be an agent of Iran? The Secretary of State today was talking in Jerusalem about Hezbollah as an agent of Iran. This is an old Cold War pattern, folks. This is not something that this administration or this Secretary of State has come to ab initio, just out of a sudden conviction, out of some kind of conversion on the road to Damascus, as it were. This is an old pattern of seeing local conflicts solely through the prism of whatever major rivalry is involved. The Soviets in the bad old days were no better. The Russians today are no better. I would guess that the Iranians aren't much better insofar as they are our rival. But this is a terribly destructive reductionist pattern. It leads us to see things solely in terms of whatever major great power conflict or whatever other major conflict we're engaged in this region. And it means that we tend to ignore the actual realities and specificities of the countries involved. In the case of Lebanon in 1958, for example, President Eisenhower, having issued the Eisenhower Doctrine, which said that the United States would go to the aid of any country threatened by international communism, invoked this doctrine to send about 20,000 American soldiers and Marines to Lebanon. The possibility of international communism taking over Lebanon in 1958 was nil. The involvement of international communism, Arab communism, or Lebanese communism in the 1958 Civil War was nil. The Lebanese Communist Party was minuscule. It played almost no role in the politics of the country. International communism was not concerned. And yet this is what the president invoked in his intervention in Lebanon, which was completely unnecessary. As soon as the American troops landed and vendors started selling them ice cream on the shores, everybody realized that this was not a country threatened by international communism. Whatever was going on there, the troops were very quickly withdrawn. An American mediator very quickly came to a deal with the Egyptians, which led to the reestablishment of a Lebanese parliamentary government that was acceptable to most Lebanese. So this is an example of an American intervention which, as I show in this book, I think did degrade in some ways the Lebanese parliamentary system, Lebanese self-reliance, the ability of the Lebanese to deal with their own conflicts. I talk about the same kind of thing happening in Jordan, and I could give you other examples. So this is a Cold War pattern which I don't think we've entirely shaken. The way in which the United States has related to Lebanon in recent years doesn't differ very much from that of the height of the Cold War. Instead of seeing Hezbollah and other parties in Lebanon, parties and actors in Lebanon, as Lebanese factions engaged in conflict over political goals that have to do primarily with Lebanon and Lebanese issues, we and other actors have tended to see them as no more than proxies for either the United States, the majority, the government in Lebanon, or for Iran and Syria in the case of Hezbollah and its allies. This did a great injustice to what was actually going on in Lebanon. It meant we did not really see what was going on in Lebanon. And more importantly, it involved the United States in exacerbating that conflict in a variety of ways. I actually experienced this when I was in Lebanon in May of this past year, of 2008, when the Lebanese government got into a showdown with Hezbollah, which led to the country almost to the brink of a new civil war. The United States didn't precipitate that, but I think American support for the majority, parliamentary majority, the government at that time, played a very negative role, as I'm willing to surmise did Iranian support for Hezbollah. So our engagement in what I call a new Cold War with Iran has extended patterns of behavior that go back to the Cold War, which I don't think have served United States interests in the sense that we're not really seeing what's going on. If we intervene in a country thinking that it's threatened by international communism, and international communism has absolutely nothing to do with what's going on, A, we make ourselves a laughingstock, and B, we're operating blindly. And I would argue that that has been the case for senior United States policymakers insofar as the Middle East is concerned, to the extent to which they have been blinded by this new Cold War with Iran, just as I would argue they were blinded by the old Cold War with the Soviet Union. That is not to say that there are not people in our working within the ranks of our government who haven't seen these things clearly. You can read the memoranda, and you can read the cables of people in the diplomatic corps, in the State Department, and people working here in Washington who saw these things perfectly clearly. But up at the top, it was Cold War considerations that predominated. One of the worst examples of this that I found in my own research was a case going back to 1971, where the Secretary of State went out to the Middle East and discovered in his discussions with President Sadat, 1971, mind you, that Egypt was prepared to enter into a peace treaty with Israel, and that it wasn't necessarily going to condition this on all the other Arab countries following suit. In other words, Egypt was ready in 1971, 8 years before an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty was actually signed, to enter into an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. According to the documents I found, Secretary of State Rogers and his assistants came back to Washington and were stonewalled by the president and the National Security Advisor, who said, oh, no. We have to get the Soviets out of Egypt. That's our primary objective. We're not going to give Sadat this. We're not going to go ahead with this. And the matter died there. The end result was the 1973 war, one of the most dangerous of the Arab-Israeli, probably the most dangerous of the Arab-Israeli wars, certainly the most destructive, with the possible exception of Lebanon, actually, in 1982, where 17,000 people were killed. The United States and the Soviet Union coming to the brink of a nuclear confrontation at the end of that conflict. All of this could have been avoided were it not for the Cold War blinkers, which afflicted the president and the then National Security Advisor. Let me conclude by talking about this new Cold War with Iran. It's very hard to shake old habits, and obviously Iran is not the Soviet Union. There is an ideological element to our confrontation with Iran, but the Soviet Union was a huge power, bordering the Middle East, with enormous capabilities for projection of power, with powerful fleets, enormous armies, huge nuclear capabilities, and very large armies. And a great deal of ideological influence in the Middle East, especially in the 1960s. Iran is a very small, relatively weak country. They can't even produce enough gasoline for their domestic consumption. This is not a highly developed country. This is a developing country with a relatively low GDP per capita, with a relatively small GDP, with enormous domestic problems, with very limited force projection capabilities, with a lot of influence, however, in the region, and which is opposed to U.S. policy in a variety of ways. There are reasons for this. One of the reasons is the very difficult and painful history of American-Iranian relations going back to our participation in the overthrow of the last freely elected democratic parliamentary government in Iranian history, and our support for the regime that followed until the 1979 revolution. Be that as it may, what we, I'm afraid, have fallen into, certainly under the last administration, is thinking of the Middle East in very much the same bipolar neo-Cold War terms, in terms of which we thought of it during the Cold War, from 1945 until the disappearance of the Soviet Union in 1990-91. And I would argue that that is, has been just as destructive, in particular for the Middle East, as was the Cold War. That had just as much of a negative, or that has been having just as much of a negative impact for the Middle East in terms of envenoming conflicts, in terms of hindering the development of democracy. And let me leave you with a point that I think is worth stressing. Insofar as the United States and the Soviet Union engaged in stoking conflict, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Arab Israeli, instead of resolving conflict, because it became, these conflicts became proxy wars in their rivalry with one another. To that extent, did they contribute to the strengthening of the executive and the weakening of the possibility of Middle East countries moving towards democracy? In particular, countries like some of the Arab countries that had weak democratic traditions. If you think a little bit about the history of the strongest, longest-lasting democracies, the United States, Britain, France, and you think about the extent to which executive power was aggrandized in World War I under President Wilson, under Clemenceau, under Lloyd George, in World War II under Winston Churchill, under President Roosevelt, you will realize that countries with the most powerful democratic traditions, with the strongest traditions of legislative restraint on the executive, have seen an enormous accretion of executive power. This is not something we should be surprised at. The founders of this republic, and I cite President Madison at the end of this book, talked about this as an enormous danger. War is the handmaiden of the aggrandizement of executive power, Madison said. I'm paraphrasing. If that is the case in the most developed, strongest constitutional governments in the world, imagine the impact of war on countries with weaker democratic traditions. Imagine the impact of constant involvement, even in a Cold War, on such countries, countries like Turkey or Iran, countries like Syria or Egypt, even Israel, which actually has a democratic system. How has constant war or involvement in constant confrontation weakened the possibility of restraint on the executive, on what a very prescient author called the national security state that developed during our Cold War in this country? These are countries that have national security states. These are countries whose executive has been strengthened and strengthened again and strengthened again by constant conflict. Now, obviously, we didn't start these conflicts in most cases, but we did exacerbate them. We did much less to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict than we did to profit from it, have our arms industries profit from it, and have our weapons systems win in wars in which they were used. The same is true of the Soviets. They profited from it, they exploited it. Instead of, I would argue, doing all that might have been done in order to resolve these conflicts. This has been very, very negative for the countries of this region, and I think that this mini Cold War has had much the same effect. I'm not saying that democracy is going to sprout all over the Middle East if these conflicts are resolved. Autocratic governments will use any excuse to spend money on security services and so forth. But one of the major props, one of the great, the national security justification, disappears the moment that these kinds of conflicts can be resolved. Think about it for a minute. It doesn't mean that the power of the state will necessarily shrink. Even in advanced constitutional governments like our own, this is a problem. But I would argue that to the extent to which we can contribute to resolving some of these regional conflicts, to that extent can we lend support to the idea that autocratic government isn't the only approach. And finally, I think we can do ourselves a service. There is very little, I would argue, to be gained by looking at things in terms of a monochromatic black and white, us and them prism, and understanding everything in this region in terms of our conflict with Iran. There are differences between American interests and Iranian interests. How those are resolved is another issue, and I'd be happy to talk about that in answer to questions. But the extent to which we have turned every conflict in the Middle East, whether in Palestine or in Lebanon, Iraq or elsewhere, into a proxy war between us and Iran, I think bespeaks a poverty of imagination, a poverty of understanding of how this region really functions, and has not served the United States. I don't think American influence has grown. And I think actually Iranian influence has grown. So it hasn't even served the objectives that it was supposed to serve. Let me leave you with this. This is a book of history It's an essay in which I try to not just talk about the Cold War, but talk about some of the lessons of the Cold War for the recent past. And I hope that this is a kind of book that will give readers a sense of not just what might have been done differently or why what happened, but what might be done differently in the future. Thank you very much. Happy to take some questions.
During the Iran-Iraq war, my sister was a physician in Tehran. Mm-hmm. And repeatedly, she was puzzled that there were no journalists from Western Europe or the States trying to cover, write any articles or do anything. Could you tell me what your take is, why that didn't happen?
Well, I don't know about the specificity of why journalists in particular did not go to Tehran to report on that war. But there was an enormous bias in favor of Iraq in the West. Iran's regime was seen as extraordinarily dangerous. The Iraqi regime, the same Iraqi regime which we've spent the last couple of decades demonizing, had been built up as a reliable potential ally of the United States. And for most of that war, the United States and its allies in Western Europe channeled enormous support to Iraq. Both in terms of weapons, though the Soviets were supplying most of the weapon systems, but also in terms of support for Iraq in building and producing chemical weapons to be used in violation of international law against Iran. Probably one of the shabbiest episodes in the history of the Western democracies.
Thank you.
This is about the nuclear armament for Iran.
Mm-hmm. I think we have to look at this at least in terms of two issues. One is the issue of nuclear proliferation generally. And this relates to the faithlessness of the existing nuclear powers in terms of trying to build down their nuclear arsenals. I was quite taken by the president's answer in his first press conference to a question by Helen Thomas about the Israeli nuclear arsenal, which is enormous and is matched with delivery systems of the highest technological sophistication. So Israel doesn't just have the bomb or a couple of hundred warheads. It has the means to deliver these things, presumably relatively accurately. I was struck by the president's response, which dodged Helen Thomas's question, but which talked about the United States and Russia and other countries building down their nuclear arsenals and about nuclear nonproliferation in the Middle East as a means of approaching this question. Now, he didn't say this is what we have to do vis-a-vis Iran, and he didn't say anything directly about Israel. I would suggest, however, that just as Israel may well feel, and I'm sure does, feel threatened by Iran and the potential acquisition by Iran of nuclear weapons, I am sure that Iran feels extremely threatened not just by Israel's possession of nuclear weapons and its capabilities vis-a-vis Iran, but also by the fact that American bases surround Iran from every direction. Every country that borders Iran harbors American military bases. I'm sure that the Iranians feel threatened by the fact that the previous administration passed through Congress, and it was reported in the papers, a bill appropriating hundreds of thousands of dollars for covert activities inside Iran. I think that the way of dealing with this has to involve both speaking to the deeper fears, not just of Israelis or Americans, but also of Iranians. And I think that the people who have the most to fear from Iran, or for that matter from Israel, are in the region. It's not the United States that has to fear Iran in the first instance. Iran may conflict with our interests, but it doesn't threaten us existentially. It's countries in the region that feel threatened existentially by one another, and the United States has to address those things. Secondly, I think the United States has to address the nuclear issue not just with a narrow focus on Iran. Now, we may believe the Iranians are particularly irresponsible. The Iranians are not entirely, and others in the Middle East are not entirely mistaken in perhaps feeling that Israel is not entirely responsible in its use of force. And people in the region may well be afraid of that. And I think we have to speak to all of those fears. I mean, we have a special relationship with Israel. We have a special sympathy for Israel. But we're not Israel's lawyer. Or perhaps we shouldn't consider ourselves Israel's lawyer. We should consider ourselves the lawyer of the United States and its interests. And we should obviously pay attention to the interests of allies, whichever they may be. But I think we have to consider how you diffuse this situation. And I think that this non-proliferation approach, difficult though it may be, is the second element in this. And the third element in this has to do with seeing in areas where you can defuse the tensions between the United States and Iran. This includes Iraq, where actually there's been a certain measure of cooperation between the United States and Iran. This includes Afghanistan, where the Secretary of State herself and I think Ambassador Holbrooke have both talked about the possibility of coming to an understanding with Iran. But this also includes much more contentious areas, Palestine, Lebanon, and so forth. I'm not suggesting that a grand bargain will be easy with Iran. It will be very, very difficult. The diffuse structure of power in Iran, the extremely irresponsible nature of the president of Iran, he shoots his mouth off in ways that can only, I think, envenom the situation. Now, he may or may not be reelected in June. He is not the primary decision maker. He is one of the people who has a share in making decisions. It's the supreme guide. It's Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei, who in fact is the decision maker, but he chooses to support Ahmadinejad in many instances, and so it's not going to be easy either to reassure the Iranians or to do a nuclear deal, which hopefully would prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, but in a way which addresses their fears of, among other things, Israel's vast nuclear arsenal, and finally to do a grand bargain, as it were. And the problem with that grand bargain, just to conclude a very long answer, is we have to do this in a way that doesn't threaten American allies. There are countries in the Gulf, Israel, other countries, which do feel threatened from Iran. Maybe they exaggerate the degree to which they feel threatened, but there is a genuine problem there. And the United States can't, as it were, throw out the baby with the bathwater. That's actually not the right metaphor. The United States can't ignore those concerns in trying to defuse the third element of that triad vis-a-vis Iran. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.